Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5. So Charles Aminiyu buried the Houston Texans yesterday. Let's listen to what he had to say. First time speaking to the San Francisco media. So the first time he has spoken to the media since he was traded by the Houston Texans to San Francisco. Charles Aminiyu.
A lot more structure. The leadership between the coach and the GM, it doesn't seem like it's a power struggle. It's very like they're on the same page. They have an understanding of what they want. They make it very clear of what they want from GM to head coach, from head coach to the position coaches. And it's not a circus show here. You guys definitely have things down packed, and you know what you want at the players. The coaches know the expectations, and it's sought out and said. And it's not a lot of switching guys from being a starter, not being a starter. Like, I mean, you understand what you're doing here and you just get it done.
All right, Charles Aminiyu yesterday sounding off on what it was like in his previous spot than in his current spot. What were some takeaways you hear whenever you listen to Charles Aminiyu put the Texans on blast?
Well, I think a lot of it relates to the locker room, the things that we've talked about with the culture, the fact that I think he was talking about, amongst others, probably Justin Reed, when you're a starter and then you're not.
I think he was talking about himself.
And as well as himself, but there's a track record, yep, right, of what they did. I think that too many people are downplaying this, and this is the one of what we've been waiting for in the past that we haven't really gotten in terms of someone that had the stones to be able to come out and say, hey, look, this is how it was. They can make their little innuendos and they make their little flippant statements, but this got a little bit deeper. The power struggle is amazing to me because I don't think that a guy like David Culley would come in guns blazing, like to try and be the almighty powerful one. But it sounds like that, you know, and a lot of times when we heard the comments we heard from players about David Culley, that they were at least willing to give him the chance to be the leader of men, but maybe he wasn't going to get that opportunity because Nick wouldn't allow it. Those are some of the early takeaways when I heard it for the first time.
How much stock would you put in this? Charles Aminiyu, who was disgruntled, wasn't happy, was traded by the Texans after he alluded to was a starter, then he's not, then he is, then he's not. How much stock are you giving it to a Charles Aminiyu who burned bridges and was traded by the Texans?
Well, I think that, look, you're not going to get complete honesty and not get a little bit one-sidedness, but you kind of expect that anyway, right? There's two sides to every story. The only, you know, caveat here is you're never going to get the other side of it because they're going to just say next question and no comment because it's over with. But it does, as a fan, as the media, as what we do on a daily basis, talking about it and analyzing it, it does bring up more questions about truly what's going on behind closed doors, truly what's happening every day in that locker room, what's happening between the front office and the coaching staff. Nick has made it very clear that it's his show and he's running it.
Mm-hmm.
But to what level, right? And how much is that rubbing the coaches the wrong way? And then how does that translate to affecting the next head coach that's thinking about taking this job?
And that's kind of been the global, or you always hear Caserio use that word, like the global viewpoint of this organization. And to me, that's the global viewpoint of how this organization is viewed by people outside of the Patriots circle, is that they look at this and they're like, man, that stuff is kind of messy right now. And even if Caserio sounds nice and friendly and is a little transparent with some other people, then you have Charles Aminiyu 2 days later talking about how much of a clown show it is, how much of how messed up things are going. And the four bullet points that stood out to me One of them was he talked about the structure. And, like, what has been the whole point of year one for Nick Caserio? It's been setting up the structure. It's been setting up the culture. We're looking at it more from, like, a process-driven viewpoint than a results-driven viewpoint. So, like, the whole year was about structure and about building this culture. He says we've done a good job laying down the foundation of where this organization's going to go, yet you have a dude who was traded halfway through the year saying the structure's jacked.
Yeah. I think that, again, as it translates, you know, there's different levels, right? There's different layers. And it, this gives you a little insight into kind of the upper layers that we weren't privy to. Because what we were privy to was players get disgruntled. And when they do, they found out that if they make it public or they make it somewhat semi-public by doing it in front of other players and doing it in the locker room and doing it on the practice field, instead of getting your hand slapped or you're punished, you find your way to greener pastures, like a Minshew is as he's getting ready to play in the divisional round of the playoffs.
Yep.
Like we saw with Zach Cunningham, who's also getting ready to play in the divisional round of the playoffs. Like we saw with Roby, who got out after two different instances where he acted up and got on a Saints team that almost made the playoffs. So you wonder what is truly going on at the different levels, and then it starts to trickle out about maybe it's okay or it's been accepted or it's been behavior that's been taking place at that level, because above them there's conflict and strife going on too in terms of a power struggle.
And that's the second bullet point that I jotted down listening to this, is the power struggle with head coach and general manager. Because like all the other stuff, that it's a clown show, that it's a circus, that they're out of structure, that the, you know, the power structure is out of sync, like that stuff is all stuff we've heard before, right? Like that's nothing new.
Right.
To me, what we heard here from Minshew that was new was the power struggle with head coach and general manager. Like I would have never thought that there was any sort of a power struggle with Nick Caserio and David Culley. Like, to me, Nick Casario's the king, and David Culley is the right-hand man to Nick Caserio. Like, I found that to be pretty shocking, hearing that from Minshew.
Well, as we talked about, I think us on the kind side, we're talking about David Culley as a bridge coach, but respecting him as the head coach. On the negative side, or the more offensive or critical side of things, people called him a puppet.
Uh-huh.
So when you are being called a puppet or a bridge coach, it's pretty clear the general manager is pulling the strings and running the show. So it's crazy to me, but also it kind of makes sense to me too, why David Culley, maybe as much as he signed up for this, by the end of it, wasn't too keen on what he signed up for, because of the fact that this sheds a little light on the fact that maybe he wasn't just going to sit there and take it. Maybe he, whether it was discussed or not, maybe he wasn't okay with being told what to say at press conferences, and the fact that, you know, he had to stick to the company line when he knew it really wasn't going the way he was supposed to say it was going.
Yeah, and it could have led to the philosophical differences, yeah, too, which I didn't put a whole lot of weight in whenever I read that. But seeing this, it, you know, it adds a little bit more merit to perhaps there was the philosophical differences and a power struggle perhaps between Caserio and Culley, which is another, you know, red flag to potential candidates who do not know Nick Caserio and Jack Easterby when they see Charles Minshew's comments about the power structure of the Houston Texans. You have Caserio in the headset. You have Caserio firing a dude in year one that he was on the headset with. And now you have a former player saying there was a power struggle with head coach and GM. And you might think that that's all hogwash. You might think that that's all bullcrap. And you might be right. But if there's a Byron Leftwich and a Doug Peterson that see that and they put stock to that, cross them off any sort of wish list that you would have as a head coach.
Yeah, because you know what? The thing is like we go back to saying that all these great coaches have always had a sounding board somewhere in the organization that can tell them when they're full of you know what. Well, the best case scenarios of organizations that work well, and you go to the Patriots way, right? And though Bill was basically wearing both hats, Bill had a relationship with everybody on the football side in management so that they could have open dialogues about a player, a position group, a philosophy, a system, whatever the case may be, from coordinators on down. The best success stories in sports, especially as it relates to professional football, are where, and we heard Randy Mueller talk about this, are when you have a really good working relationship of dialogue and communication between coach and general manager. You may not always agree, but you also agree to take a look at, like, you and I, well, we argue on a lot. I say argue. We discuss a lot of things passionately, right? But I'm open to hearing your side of it. I'm going to tell you when I see, okay, you know what? Now yeah, that we've talked about it, And that's the way it's got to work. It doesn't seem like that's what they had, and I don't know that he's out to do that this time either. That's part of the reason why I like Brian Flores so much, because Brian Flores at least seems like the guy that's not going to be walked over.
He wouldn't be walked over. I'll give you that, and I'm not on the Brian Flores campaign. It might be a huge indicator and a huge hint, too, as to who the next head coach is going to be for the Houston Texans. You mentioned the Randy Mueller. Brendan pulled some sound from Billy Devaney, who is a former GM with the St. Louis Rams. He joined us earlier in the week as well, and he made a point, which is very relevant today, that the Texans players have to know who their guy is.
Here's where I kind of have a problem with it. The optics are terrible. Here you got the general manager and the boss, and that's who's communicating with the head coach. The locker room needs to know, who is our guy? Who's the face of the franchise? Who's our boss? And, you know, last year, looking from the outside, you had Nick and you had David Coley. The player, you know, the locker room's like, okay, who's really calling the shots around here? That head coach needs to be the guy.
That's fascinating now after hearing Charles Omenihu talk. Because yep. We had Devaney on, what was it, Monday or Tuesday? And now you have Omenihu saying this 2 days later after we even had Devaney on. But he could see that from a GM's point of view, looking down at the organization, saying, look, that the little, if you want to call it a power struggle, if you want to call it who's the face of the franchise, who's the guy making the decisions. Like, Nick Caserio wants to be Bill Belichick. He wants to be Bill Belichick without being the head coach. He wants to be the dude that's doing the podcast and the shows with Vandermeer and with Harris. He wants to have that every single week. He wants to be the voice of this organization. He wants to be on the headset. He's going to be defensive whenever you ask him about being on the headset as well. And Charles Omenihu, former Houston Texans, flat out saying, look, it's not clear what they wanted. They said what the expectations are now here in San Francisco. That wasn't always a message given to the players and the Texans, which very much sounds like blurred lines of what the Houston Texans are doing right now. And it sounds like, to me, it's very alarming. It's alarming that Charles Omenihu said that. And Brendan, when we were chatting about this in the pre-show meeting, you had a different point of view, which I'm very curious to hear.
Well, I think I've been through a lot of this
as a battered Detroit fan.
But when you're trying to change a culture, there are always going to be dudes who aren't, and their fault or not, who aren't going to fully accept that. I think guys who were traded in this season, I'm not too worried about what they have to say because you're so early in the process of creating a new culture. Like, I'm not saying that the Texans are going to be successful in creating what they want. I'm just not worried about dudes who didn't buy into how long was the menu here this year?
This was, how many games?
Yeah.
I think it was like 5 or 6.
5 games? I'm not worried about 5 games into the new culture, what he sees. And here's the other thing. It can be hard to not let what you've been burned by in the past affect your vision of the present. I'm not saying there's nothing there. It's certainly something to talk about. I wouldn't be worried about it.
See, the thing to me is the time between. Like, this is almost 3 months later that he still has these thoughts about the Houston Texans. And to your point, when he's about to play in the divisional round of the playoffs, and it's still something that spurns him.
But I think just like what we talked about when Vrabel let Zach Cunningham be the captain and do the little kind of subtle jabs that they did too. I don't think this stuff's going away. I think that there's bigger fish to fry if you're worried about the Houston Texans. Like, you can sit there and you can nitpick this, but whatever power struggle was, it's over now, at least for the time being, because Cully's gone. The bigger issue is it going to come back again when they hire their next head coach? And then when you start thinking about it, whatever the cultural issues were in the locker room or weren't, and all the things that we're going through, they were part of the reason that there was a problem. Because there were veterans that have experienced other situations that knew that this wasn't the team for them. They didn't want to be there. It was an ugly lose-lose situation that they were trying to get out of. So now going into next year, if you get a fresh roster, if you get new talent that conceivably is going to be here for a while that you're going to develop, that you can change all of that going forward. So I do think that we always say the truth lies somewhere in the middle. I do think that there's some substance to what Omenihu said, but I also think that you can also spend a little bit too much time worried about it, concerned about it, and trying to nitpick through it. It's just that it's not as perfect as Caserio would like you to believe.
To me, it's alarming, and it's another sign of the unprecedented power that Nick Caserio has, to where the players don't even know who the face of the franchise is. Houston, I'm wondering how you feel about this. How much stock are you putting into Charles Omenihu calling the Houston Texans a circus show? Does it matter? Does it not? Love to hear from you. 713-780-ESPN. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Your team's our priority. Join the conversation with the Killer Bees. Now coming to you live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
I love it. The organization, has, like I said, has a lot of structure. This is not an ego-driven kind of organization. It's not a power struggle either. So it's definitely good to experience that.
That was Charles Domenihue yesterday talking about the Houston Texans organization. The circus show, that's the quote that got all the headlines. That's the one that everybody tweeted about. But that soundbite we just heard, not an ego-driven organization talking about the Houston Texans. Like, one of the huge concerns I have about Nick Caserio is that he's very proud, that he has a lot of pride, and that he's very stubborn. He's stubborn so much that, like, okay, I was on the headsets in New England. I'm going to continue being on the headsets here no matter who my head coach is going to be. He's stubborn to the point where I'm going to bring in these old veterans that are going to help me build this culture. I'm going to force the culture down the throats of all of these players. That leads to Zach Cunningham not being happy and forcing his way out. That leads to Justin Reed being suspended for a game. Charles Domenihue, obviously, still very upset. We heard Whitney Merciless when he went to Green Bay talking about the tippity-top of the organization was a concern. Randall Cobb, when he went to Green Bay, saying Green Bay's like a Fortune 500 company and the Houston Texans are this startup. The pride of Nick Caserio could be the fall of Nick Caserio.
I don't think there's any question, but he was also groomed by a guy that thinks the same way. He just had a lot more skins on the wall and you know, had a lot more respect across the league for things that he had already achieved and done. But I think that's what you signed up for when you were the Houston Texans and you brought this guy in. Whether you knew it at the time or not, then that's on you. You didn't do enough research and you just let Action Jack go out there and get who he wanted.
That's exactly what happened.
And then you had to you were left to deal with the consequences, both good and bad. We're still waiting to see if they're good or bad. But you're right. There's certain things that show tendencies that are a little bit alarming. They're concerning. I don't know if they're alarming yet, but they are concerning. And the biggest alarming move was firing your head coach after one season. Other than that, they were all minor moves we've talked about. They could be concerning. But he really hasn't put his stamp on the map one way or the other with anything major until he fired his head coach. But when you start thinking about it, going, again, this is the problem when you have a guy. And I mean, again, I use examples that I'm familiar with. But when you have a guy that followed Daryl Morey around for a year, but you expect him to be the next Daryl Morey and Rafael Stone, you have to be careful what you're doing when you don't do enough research. How many times have we seen across all of sports from Gerson Rosas, who was supposed to be the next Daryl Morey, and in two different places, they couldn't get rid of him fast enough. And in one place, he cut his own throat, his last stop. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't get rid of him fast enough or start having really serious buyer's remorse a couple weeks into the job because they're like, wait a minute, this is how many times did we see Theo Epstein or, you know, guys like that too, where whether it's the Moneyball philosophies or from a manager, a head coach, all of a sudden you think that because they have a title that associates them very closely with the job that was done by that person, that they suddenly are going to be that person and do the same kind of things and have the same kind of results. It just doesn't work that way.
David tweeting at us saying Nick needs to decide if he's going to be the GM or a coach. Pick a lane. Him on the headset during the games is a non-starter. It'll keep them from getting a quality coach that isn't a Patriot. Like, we were talking about the power the other day that Nick Caserio had. People are like, well, who cares? Who cares about the power? Like, the people that are saying who cares about the power, they cannot see beyond the Texans' walls. Like, they can't see the big picture of the NFL and how this is a deterrent. Like, everybody, oh, he can be on the headset. That helps on game day. Sure, it might. Like, I'm not denying that. But it's also going to keep people away from your organization.
And let's also be clear. It can help if he was doing what he previously did in New England, but he can't do those same things because he now has a title that no matter what you want to believe on the outside, won't allow him to do the same things here. Because the title alone will intimidate people, will bother people, will piss people off to where he can't do what he used to do. Because no matter what happens, he's also verbalizing. He's also getting involved in the discussions and the communications.
Yeah.
And then you've got coaches and otherwise going, time out. I don't feel comfortable. He's breathing down our necks on every decision we make. How the hell are we supposed to relax and do our job?
That's why it's going to have to be somebody he's friends with that can, like, have that conversation with him and their buds. And, like, you don't look at him as a superior. You look at him as an equal. That's why I think Jerod Mayo is somebody that's qualified. Now, the pushback that I would have with that in terms of, like, optimizing what game day is, he was right whenever he told David Culley to let the Patriots score. So, like, that's the other side of it. But, like, the global perception of the Texans from around the NFL, they're going to look at this and be like, oh, come on, man.
But, Jeremy, the same way he had the job in New England.
Mm-hmm.
You can hire a guy to do exactly what you did in New England instead, so it's not you.
I would agree.
That's the key here. Because there's just too much that can go wrong or has a negative connotation with him with his title being on that headset. You can find another analytics guy that has the card in his breast pocket of his jacket and can tell you, hey, you know what? We need to let him score here. On third down and whatever, this is the play that's going to work 9 times out of 10. On fourth and whatever, if we're on this yard line and in, we're going for it. Those are the kind of things you can hire someone else to do. But you're creating negative waves you don't need right now because you, with your title, you're insistent on still being on the headset.
And the scary thing here is the pride. The pride not to realize how that's a conversation, right? The pride to not realize and the failure to realize that this is something that could have a negative connotation on you. This texter saying to me, Cully was an outlier. Like, Cully was clearly unqualified. I still think that Caserio was not 100% into his hiring. Easterby and the McNairs wanted to give Cully the chance. He proved his head coaching virginity way too much to bear. Caserio whacked him. I don't know how much of the head coaching hire was Easterby and McNair. I would say very little.
I agree.
To me, they knew at the very beginning, whether it was the triad or whether it was just Caserio, that David Cully was going to come in here and be a bridge. I think we can all agree to that, right? He was going to be here for probably 2 years. They were going to fire him after the 2 seasons, and then he was going to get his guy. The process got sped up. They had to do it after 1 season, and that's why this hire is going to be so critical to the future of Nick Caserio. And I think all of the evidence that we've pointed in the past, whether it's the headset, whether it's O'Minihue saying they have blurred lines and there's a power struggle with head coach and general manager. Like, they don't know what the expectations are. The ego of Nick Caserio, where he feels like he's the smartest guy in the room and won't even entertain the conversation of not being on the headset. Like, something that's so simple. To me, that's why it's a huge sign that it's going to be a buddy. It's going to be somebody that he's known for a long time to be the head coach of the Houston Texans.
But Jeremy, it might get to the point where he does finally. Some people, it takes longer than others. Like, he finally came out and had comments about Jack Easterby, which we were waiting for like months. So it is possible that after some serious evaluation in the offseason, that next season or sometime right before next season, he comes out and goes, look, after looking at the whole situation, it's probably best I don't get on the headset. But that's going to be determined more by the head coach. That's going to be determined more by the next guy that comes in that's either signing up for it or not. Because the one thing that caught me, too, with the comments you were just making is you were going to fire him after 2 years. I think there was a legit chance, and I think that in thinking about this more, the conversations that went on with Cully, whether Easterby and Cal had anything to do with it, I don't think they did at all. But I think that Nick probably was the kind of guy that said, look, if you do this and do this well and be the good Texan we need you to be, take some bullets, but you go with us along the way. There's a Romeo Crennel type opportunity for you too. We're not going to fire you after 2 years. You've got a 5-year deal. And if we at some point feel like it's time to move on to the next head coach, if you do what you were supposed to do in the short term, we're going to take care of you long term. We could make you a consultant. We could make you a vice president. We could move you up as you want to fade into the sunset. This could be the end of your career move where you're only going to be with us the rest of the way. So I think firing sounded a little harsh to me for the simple fact that if he did what they wanted him to do, whether he knew what they wanted and expected or not. It sounds like with the power struggle comments, maybe he didn't know all of it.
Yeah.
But if he did go and be a good soldier, I think there was an opportunity for him to be here a long time.
Do you think it's a circus show?
I really do.
This text is interesting to me. I think the moment that Cully was announced as head coach, that's when the circus started. Sure, the O'Brien season collapse was funny too, but the circus didn't start until they decided to hire a person who'd never been a coordinator or league player.
Disagree.
When do you think it's? Because I disagree too. I'm curious when you think the circus started.
And just right off the cuff, in trying to answer that and trying to think back to all the different missteps that they made, I want to say that the circus took 3-ring status when Jack Easterby got on that plane with Cal and went and got Nick, because they took a 6-figure agreement of commitment to a committee to find them candidates. Those people that were instilled with doing that responsibility are highly regarded, experienced people that put together a list that said, we're not telling you which one to pick, but we're telling you if you pick one of these, you probably won't go wrong. And the fact that one guy was able to go completely off the board and get the owner's plane and then get the owner to buy in within 24 hours and then get the guy that no one had on their list, that's when I think we went full-blown circus mode.
To me, the circus started on June 7th, 2019, when they fired Brian Gain. Jack Easterby was already in the building. Bill O'Brien was already in the building. They had one decent mind who could handle the general managing job, and because he was the dissenting opinion to Bill O'Brien, who clearly and obviously we know now had no idea what he was doing as a GM, Jack Easterby, who clearly and obviously had no business being a general manager, Brian Gain was the dissenting opinion. And whenever he sounded back and whenever he pushed back at Bill O'Brien and Jack Easterby, what did they do? They fired him on June 7, 2019. That opened the floodgates for what was a period of time which was the worst GM jobs in NFL history, whether it was trading DeAndre Hopkins, whether it was trading for Laremy Tunsil, all of the other moves too, a third rounder for Duke Johnson, who was a backup running back. The day they fired Brian Gain is when the circus show started.
It's up for discussion, right? Because I think yours gets more to the nuts and bolts from a general manager position. Mine gets more into the overall of the entire franchise from ownership on down. For like who's running the show and how the hell are you doing one thing and letting people spend time and money for an extended period of time to make sure you don't screw up and then you screw up.
713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776, HR&P listener line, number to call, number to text. We'll get to some of your reaction when we return. Also, Carlos Correa is a Boris guy. Boris detailed how he's going to get Correa paid. Was he talking to Jim Crane when he said this? It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Hey, guys, you're looking for something new and different to do, whether it be on a date night or hanging out with your buddies and your friends or maybe a great place to take the family and the kids where it's actually time-consuming so that you get the kids out of the house and away from the screens, but also everybody has fun in the process? Well, I'm telling you, it's going on right now at Discovery Green, and it's called Pixar Putt. And you know Pixar. Pixar is the film company that's responsible for movies like Toy Story, The Incredibles, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, and more. You know, my kids love them, and your kids do, too. They know all the characters and all the stories and all the iconic moments. Well, now they're all intertwined into 18 fun, interactive mini putt-putt golf holes that are going to be something that you and the whole family or a date or your friends can do. And it's right there in the middle of Discovery Green. So you're right nearby bars and restaurants. You can make it a whole evening. You can have a whole lot of fun. And it's different and it's off the beaten path from what you normally do. It's fantastic. You can check it out. PixarPutt.com. PixarPutt.com. That's the only way you can get tickets, too. But it's right there at Discovery Green. It's only going on until March 20th, so you want to take part in it before it's too late. But I'm telling you right now, go and check it out. The kids are going to love it. My family is a big fan of all of it, and you can, too. At a date night, you don't want to go to a movie and not talk for 2 hours. I mean, Brendan's constantly in this dilemma. Now you can go and play putt-putt golf instead and have a great time for a couple hours and then go knock back some beverages or have some food and discuss everything. That's the way you can go about it. You can do it with your buddies. You can do it on a date. You can do it with your family. But you can only do it till March 20th, so you need to act now. Go to PixarPutt.com for tickets and information. That's PixarPutt.com.
Instant Match instantly connects you with quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your sponsored job description. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get $75 towards your first sponsored job. Terms and conditions apply.
Your team's our priority. Join the conversation with the Killer Bees. Now coming to you live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. So we know now Scott Boras is the agent for Carlos Correa. He'll be representing Carlos Correa in free agency if the lockout ever ends. And we're getting closer and closer to when pitchers and catchers are supposed to report. And still no real indication that the labor dispute's going to end anytime soon. Mark Berman caught up with Scott Boras some way, somehow. Mark Berman's a wizard. But he caught up with him at the airport. Baggage claim, I don't know where it was in the airport. But Mark Berman found him some way, somehow. And Scott Boras gave a little bit of an indication on what the plans are for Carlos Correa.
Well, where I think he fits in is that there are always owners who are ready to make the best business decision. One they'll always remember. And I can think back in my history of the game of doing things that there were times that they didn't know what they were thinking initially, and as time went on, they realized that I don't get a chance to make decisions like this maybe in my ownership history or maybe in a decade, and that I want to exercise every opportunity to acquire something that I know may not be available.
So that was Scott Boras, the agent for Carlos Correa, talking with Mark Berman at the airport, because Mark Berman's a gangster and figures out ways to talk to dudes whenever no one even knows they're in town. But do you feel like Scott Boras was talking to Jim Crane? Like, we know the idea and the motto of Scott Boras is to not play the GMs, because GMs usually don't overspend, or they don't make, you know, market decisions that they're going to spend way too much in a player. Usually those bad decisions come from ownership. And the way that Jim Crane, or the way that Scott Boras does that, is he plays to the feelings. He plays to the heartstrings. Oh, you got to have this guy. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This is the guy that's going to get you over the hump to win that World Series, which you want to have in your ownership period. Do you feel like Boras was talking to Jim Crane?
I do. I believe that he was talking to Jim Crane. I believe that he was talking to James Click. And I don't believe that either one give a rat's ass what he has to say, because that's what he's paid to do. That's the Scott Boras that they know, that we know, that everybody has known and really doesn't love when it comes to the hardline business of being a sports agent and doing it at the level that he's done it for many years. His only objective is to get every freaking penny out of every contract that he gets for every one of his clients. Whether he does that all the time or not, ask Dallas Keuchel, that's another story. But for the most part, he's had a hell of a success rate. And you know what? He's going to talk the same way to them in meetings than he's talking to the media, trying to send the subliminal messages. And we talked about that. He's using the media as a pawn now as he hits the ground running, trying to pick up where all the pieces of what was left behind and what Correa didn't get yet that he's trying to make up for. He's trying to get a Corey Seager-type deal and more. He's trying to pressure the organization into going against their philosophies. And I think the one thing, like I said, Crane is the X factor. At some point, he might just blow up everything that has been put in front of him from a plan perspective that Click has. And I believe Click has a plan. But I believe that plan is centered around what we've talked about. Not giving a long-term deal in the amount of years Correa wants. Not giving a massive deal with all the money that Correa wants, that he's even said in negotiations, the Astros have said they're not interested in doing. My sources a while back told me they weren't willing to go more than 5 years. They might fudge by a year or so. You never know when push comes to shove in negotiations. But essentially, we know that no matter what Boras says publicly or is saying to those guys, I believe they're going to stay steadfast to their plan, which doesn't involve $300 million in 10 years for Carlos Correa.
John Heyman reporting that Correa is still looking for $330 million. That was the baseline before the lockout. It's still the baseline now. I still think he's going to get it. I know that he doesn't have the offers, and I think one of the reasons he went to is Scott Boras is because he didn't necessarily like the offers that he got pre-lockout. As far as the Jim Crane side of this conversation, though, nothing that Jim Crane has done has made me think that he's, like, irrational. The closest thing that you could say that he did that was, like, following his heart instead of his head was the Justin Verlander contract this offseason, right? Where he gave him the $25 million for 1 year, and then he also gave him a $25 million player option for next season. Now, we did learn later on that there's a little bit of a caveat there, that Verlander has to hit an inning threshold for that player option to be something that would vest, and then Verlander would have that. So I've never seen Jim Crane act with his heart as an Astro owner. So where it does sound like Scott Boras is not only talking to Jim Crane here, but he's talking to every other owner around Major League Baseball and trying to convince all of these owners that Carlos Correa is this once-in-a-lifetime talent, which I don't really believe to be the case. I don't see Jim Crane acting with his heart. I don't see him making an irrational decision.
I don't either. But he did it with Verlander.
But even that was 2 years, though, right?
But he's coming off Tommy John.
With some insurance.
He's coming off Tommy John. So that gives you a little bit of a red flag. That's one where I'm not sure James Click on his own makes that deal. But I believe that because of the influence of Jim Crane and his relationship with Justin Verlander and what Verlander did when he was called to duty in Houston means something to Jim Crane. And so, therefore, I believe he got involved. So I'm saying, when we talked about the percentages before, that's why the door's not completely shut. Because at some point, Jim Crane might just say, hey, look, I got to have this guy. Now, I don't think it's going to go against what we think the plan is that we just highlighted. I don't think he's going to go for 10 years. I don't think he's going to go for $300 million. I think he'd be more apt to go to a short-term deal at more than anybody would have thought that Carlos Correa could get each year.
Like a $40 million average annual value?
Correct. Yeah. For two or three to try and appease him in the short term so that, like to Boras's point, they can still focus on the window still being open with a chance to run after another ring. But I don't think he's going to change the core value of his baseball operations department. I do think that he does understand the sentimental value Carlos Correa has in the city of Houston.
He's also been willing to let sentimental value go away, though. You know, just as the pushback. And you're not saying that Crane's going to advocate for Correa, so it's not really an argument with you. But Crane has allowed the sentimental value of the city of Houston to leave before. Now, I don't know if I would put Gerrit Cole in that conversation, but that was the dude who was the best starting pitcher entering free agency, and he put on the Scott Boras hat after they lost in Game 7 of the 2019 World Series. But the player that I'm referring to is George Springer. I mean, they let George Springer walk, who was the heartbeat of the Houston Astros for a very long time, right? Like, he was the energy of the team. He was the lifeblood of the team. And the Astros were never even really engaged in negotiations with George Springer because they didn't want to give that long-term contract. I think that the way that they handled the George Springer contract is going to be the same way that they handled the Carlos Correa contract. So why Boras is talking to every owner, including Jim Crane, in this, I just don't see the Astros being a realistic option for Carlos Correa.
Who has more emotional ties in the overall situation, Springer, Correa?
You're talking about for the history of the Houston Astros, yeah, this window that we're currently
in? How it relates to either Crane and or the fan base and everybody involved.
I would lean George Springer. George Springer was the cover boy on Sports Illustrated that predicted the World Series. He was the cover boy after they won the World Series, and he was the World Series MVP for the only World Series championship in franchise history.
And George Springer is one of my favorite all-time Astros, and I would have leaned your way until we got it knee-deep into this situation. The fact that, once again, during this year's playoffs, and again, people look past the fact that he didn't have a good playoffs, but because he had Correa time and pointed to his wrist and had one of those monumental moments that's going to sit in the hearts and minds of Astros fans in the lore of history for this baseball team, I think it may have flipped. And I think that there might be more emotions involved. I don't think there was any emotions at the end of the Springer deal. I think that everybody had basically come to an understanding that we loved you when you were here. I loved being in Houston when I was here, but I'm going where the money is, and we're not. And from the other side, we're not going to be able to pay you. So thanks for the memories, and good luck unless you're playing us. I don't think that they're fully to that point yet with Carlos Correa because of what's just happened recently. Even though they didn't win another World Series, I think there's enough on the bone there that have kind of, that's kind of flipped the script.
I don't disagree with that. Like, if it was an 80-20 split before, where like it was 80% Springer, 20% Correa, the prisoner of the moment mindset that's natural as human beings, I think moved it closer to 50-50. So the fan base like perspective of that, I'm pretty interested in. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Yesterday we talked about Mel Kiper's mock draft. Well, Todd McShay's pretty good at what he does as well. Todd McShay has a thought that Evan Neal could go number one in this draft. Why that's significant? Also, it's Girl Scout cookie season. That's next. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Before we go to the break, we know that the divisional round of the NFL is going to be Saturday and Sunday, and everybody's going to be glued to the screen. Maybe your favorite team's no longer in it, Dr. Dre. Then maybe you want to do something about that and still be able to make the games more interesting. Well, you can put money down, and the only place that I encourage you to put your money down is mybookie.ag, and it's simple. It's because when you put money in, they take care of it, make sure it's safe and secure, it doesn't disappear, nor does the company that you're investing with. On top of that, when you win, they pay you, and they make sure that if you win, they're not going to hem and haw and encourage you to keep it in your account and keep betting with it because they really don't have the cash to kick out. No, they'll get it to you, and they'll make sure that if you want your money back, you'll get it. And on top of all that, they also have lots of promotions and things where you can capitalize by either doubling your deposit or getting an opportunity to actually get in on a bet that you don't have to pay for, but if you win, you're going to get paid for. Those are things they do on a daily basis. It, right now, the promotion is, like I was talking about, double your next deposit up to $1,000. So simply put, go to mybookie.ag and log on, set up an account if you're new, or get back on your account if you've had one in the past. Put in the promo code BET975 and then put money in your account. Whatever you put in is going to be doubled up to $1,000, and that means more money in your account, more games to bet on, more chances to win. That's the way they do business on a daily basis. Check them out because they got all the sports, all the games, live in-game betting, all from soccer and NBA basketball to the NFL playoffs and college basketball. They've got it if you want to bet on it and you have a chance to win. You know, if you got a hunch, play it and make the game more interesting. You want to bet on your laptop, your phone, your tablet, you got it. You want to bet with cryptocurrency, or you want to write a check or use your credit card, you can do it. They take care of the little things, so you can bet big if you care to, but you can win when you have the chance. Check them out today, mybookie.ag. Put in the promo code BET975. Bet anywhere, anytime, any place with MyBookie.
Talking sports with you, not at you. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Now from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5, ESPN at 92.5. Having the conversation earlier about Carlos Correa now being represented by Scott Boras, you brought up the interesting question of like who's a bigger poster boy for this Astros era, George Springer or Carlos Correa. Demetrius wants to weigh in, calling on the HRMP listener line, 713-780-3776. Demetrius, you're in the Hive with the Killer Bees. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the point that I don't know if you guys brought it up, but the only reason us as fans were even okay with the Astros letting go of Springer is because we thought Correa was absolutely getting that money that they were going to give Springer. There's no way we would have been okay with having now two holes in our defense, Correa leaving and Springer gone, because now we need a center fielder, if we thought the Astros wasn't going to take that money that they didn't give George Springer and sign Correa. Knowing what we know now, I think most fans, if you polled us all, would say keep Springer 100% than have this hole that we're going to have by losing both of them, because I don't think the Astros are going to take a risk.
I think it's a good point about the domino effect. Like, okay, if you lose Springer first, then on the tail end of that, you better lock up Correa, and appreciate the call, Demetrius. The one issue that I have whenever we discuss Carlos Correa is everybody forgets that at one point, Carlos Correa was not that well-liked in this city. People thought he was a disappointment. He was getting the rib cracked. He was dating, you know, Daniela Rodriguez at the time. They were like, she was showing up on the YouTube channel.
She was giving updates on all of his injuries instead of him.
There was a point in time between when the Astros won the World Series in 2017 and prior to when Carlos Correa went out of the Astros clubhouse at spring training and told everybody to shut the you-know-what up. Between that time, there was a lot of disdain for Carlos Correa in this city. It might not be that way right now, but the one problem that I have whenever we have the Carlos Correa conversation is when people act like that does not exist and it hadn't ever happened before.
No, it's absolutely spot on true. And I think that when you look at the overall big picture, he was nitpicked a lot, and then he was nitpicked more because of Daniela, and then he was nitpicked more because some of his own kind of missteps. But then you start looking at just from the baseball player perspective. He had as many lows as he had highs.
Yes.
He had as many injuries as he had full seasons, or more injury plagued seasons than he had full seasons. Now, to his credit, he bet on himself this last year and he won, right? But I also think along the way, and it's crazy because it's revisionist history to some degree, but it's also riding the wave of emotion, right? And the heartstrings of Astros fans, as we know, are deep and they're loyal. I think that when Springer left to Tina Turner's song, they needed another hero. They needed someone else that they could grasp onto, not just from their playing, but their leadership and their kind of cockiness. Alex Bregman, it left. Carlos Correa said, let it be me. And I don't know if it was because it's a contract year. I don't know if it was because he knew that there was a need for it too. But we remembered how much Springer kept the locker room loose, but got in an umpire and dropped F-bombs when they were getting screwed, but was talking to A.J. Hinch and constantly getting into the baseball side of things, and was outside the dugout cheerleading on every big play. Carlos kind of took the baton and ran with it. And then, like you said, there were certain key quotes, certain key plays that suddenly got the attention of the fan base even more, and suddenly they fell in love. Because you're right, there was a time that they were ready for a divorce, but suddenly they came full circle and they fell in love. But now, with other people's money, they want to stay in a marriage for $300 million in 10 years. And you're not quite sure how ugly she's going to become in those next 10 years, both the way she treats you and her appearance and what you get out of it.
JD saying on Twitch, the only people who had disdain for Correa were complete idiots.
That's not true.
I think both things are true. He's not saying that those people didn't exist. He's saying the people that were saying that were the ones that were idiots. And I agree with that, actually. Like, people were acting like Carlos Correa was this, like a bust. They were calling him Jadeveon Clowney. At the time when people were sour on Carlos Correa, he was a far better player than the perception of this city. And it's now where I think he's actually a little bit overrated by the city. And you know how I feel about Carlos Correa. Carlos Correa is my favorite player. I think think he's the smartest baseball player in all of Major League Baseball. At the same time, I would not pay him $330 million because his production to this point in his career does not show a $330 million player. This past season, he was very good. His bat was all right as a shortstop. His glove was phenomenal. But that's not going to equate to $330 million for the next 10 seasons. And I love Carlos Correa. I do. 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. So I saw this trending the other day. I haven't seen the people yet, the Girl Scouts out in front of the local grocery store quite selling it yet as hard, the hard sell that the Girl Scouts have with those Girl Scout cookies. But you know it's Girl Scout cookie season, right? You know Girl Scout cookie season is here. It's now. It's the right this moment. You a big Girl Scout cookie guy?
No. And you know what's funny, though? It's because I'm not the sweets guy like my wife is massive on. She loves sweets. And this is before she turned the page and went like over the top full vegan. But she's a sweetaholic, and I'm not. But there are certain sweets that I like. It's weird because I don't like mint at all. And I don't like mint ice cream. I don't like, besides from gum, I just am kind of anti-mint. But thin mint cookies have always been the end-all be-all. And I saw a survey a week or two ago that it's crazy to me with how much America loves peanut butter, how much America loves fudge striped and chocolate, right? The fact that I think 3/4 or more of the nation said it's like on a runaway, thin mint is the best Girl Scout cookie ever made.
Really?
And that kind of surprised me.
Did it offend you even?
It didn't offend me, no, because for me to say that I don't like mint, but that I like thin mint cookies, kind of tells you they kind of found that formula that almost everybody could be okay with.
I like thin mint cookies. To me, there's a top tier of Girl Scout cookies. Thin mint is definitely one of them, and I like it chilled, whether it's the refrigerator or whether it's the freezer. Either way is fine, but I like it chilled. Thin mint's in my top tier. The second one that's in my top tier might not be a popular decision. Caramel Delights. And those also have to be chilled. Caramel Delights are fantastic. They're outstanding. They have a piece of coconut. I usually don't even like caramel.
Oh, man. God, I was going to say, growing up, the one thing that was the game changer for me was anything to do with caramel. You can call it caramel. You can call it whatever you want. Caramel, to me, game changer in a positive way. And the other thing, you're right, though. If you, like, when we were growing up, you would, and me being the little fat kid, you would freeze Snickers bars, and it makes them that much better. But I think this is where I think people can, it kind of gets lost in the shuffle. When it's Girl Scout cookie season, it's almost like that's all that we're talking about.
Yep.
And so they go crazy about the Girl Scout factor of what cookies you have to choose from. In terms of the overall big picture, rate the cookies. Thin mints aren't even in the top 3 or 4.
For you?
Yeah.
What's ahead of it?
Chocolate chip cookies by far number one in a landslide.
Oh, so you're not talking about Girl Scouts here.
I'm talking about overall in the big picture of just the best cookies ever baked.
You're talking about cookie genre now.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's saying that Girl Scout cookies are overrated, and I kind of agree with him.
That's a terrible take by both of you.
It's fact. It's absolute fact. Like, if we didn't have a time of the year and know that it's for a good cause and know that everybody, whether they really care for the cookies or not, they care for their buddy whose daughter is selling them and they want to do the right thing, they get too over the top, kind of sucked into the Girl Scout cookie perspective. But in terms of how they sit in the overall food chain of cookies, they're not even close.
Uncle Barney, for the first time in his life, has agreed with you and not me.
He says, Barney,
in the big picture, the Girl Scout cookies are overrated. I couldn't disagree more. Give me the Caramel Delights year-round? Absolutely. Thin Mints year-round? Absolutely. I'm not a huge sweet guy. I'm not a huge cookie guy. I do like Oreos because it's Milk's favorite cookie.
There's another one.
But Brendan's got a look of disgust on his face because he's always got hot food takes.
I think there are only two Girl Scout cookies worth even like bothering with.
To me, there's three.
It's Thin Mints and it's Tagalongs, the peanut butter chocolate. Like, that's it. I don't need to mess with anything else. But I do agree with Joel that it is a seasonal thing that you get excited for seasonal reasons. They're pretty whatever. I said to you, I feel like everybody always gets Girl Scout cookies, but they're not good enough to justify that.
Let me just tell you this. Shots
fired at the Girl Scouts. You guys hate Girl Scouts.
No, it's not. See, you have to take it to the next level. It has nothing to do with hating children.
Oh, yeah. I'm the one that takes it to the next level.
That are in the Girl Scout organization. It's about the fact that if you give people the option, you know how the people at the malls come out with the trays? If you gave the food court.
Yeah.
So if you had someone with a tray of thin mints,
yeah,
come out, and you had someone with a tray of those piping hot chocolate chip cookies that are coming out of whatever,
from like a Doubletree.
Yeah, no, not from the Doubletree. What's the Brendan? What's the food court chocolate chip cookie? The original cookie company.
Toll House.
Mrs. Fields is what
I. Or Mrs. Fields. If you're telling me that walking straight down the middle of the line, and a tray comes out of Thin Mints, and a tray comes out from Mrs. Fields, and you got to choose one or the other. I'm telling you right now, with the hot chocolate chip cookies, you're an idiot if you take the Thin Mint. And I don't think that, I think we're over 90% taking chocolate chip.
How come you asked Brendan about the cookies and not me? You looked directly at Brendan when you were asking about the name of the cookie place.
Because like, for like once, we're on the same page with something, and we're also from the same neck of the woods, and I wanted to see if we can continue this.
There are two genres of food in which I feel I'm undefeated, and it's cookies and pretzels.
Okay. Now pretzels. I'm interested about the pretzel take.
I'm just a soft pretzel guy.
Yeah. I mean, soft pretzels are good from time to time. I like Auntie Annie's at the airport. Yeah. I mean, I don't – my wife loves pretzels with mustard, with beer cheese. I like it too, but it's never something like I think about. You know what I mean?
I think Wetzel's Pretzels outdoes Auntie Annie's.
What's your order from Auntie Annie's?
It's not, because I skip Auntie Annie's and I go down the mall a little further and I go to Wetzel's Pretzels.
But it's the same thing, right?
No, it's really not.
But I mean, they make
Brendan's point, if you're a connoisseur, it's like me with ketchup.
Well, that's talking about the quality. But they serve the same stuff. One just does it better, right? Like,
also with my kids, Wetzel's Pretzels does the bag-o pretzels. Pretzel bites.
I think Auntie Annie's does that too.
No, they put them in a cup.
They do the cup.
And so from a financial perspective of return on investment and getting the most for your money, you get more out of the bag than you do the cup.
Do they have the little like the little mini corn dogs, but it's breaded with the pretzel instead? I like those things for some reason. I don't know why.
It's almost a kolache, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know why I like it. I usually don't like hot dogs kolaches.
They put jalapenos in there. They got all different variations. Pizza, pretzel bites, all those things.
Joel says Girl Scout cookies are overrated.
They are.
Do you agree? 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. All right, when we come back.
Wait, before we get any further on this, you're telling me if you are that guy walking through the food court.
Yeah, I'll take Caramel Delights.
You're going to take a tray with cold Caramel Delights as opposed to
Why do they have to be cold?
Because that's what Girl Scout cookies are.
I mean, they're not usually coming fresh out of the oven. They're usually room temperature, unless you put them in the refrigerator.
Okay, so they're coming out of your plastic sterile package slapped on a tray, or you're getting right out of the oven.
Caramel Delights, 10 times out of 10. Oh. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, when we come back, Todd McShay entertains the idea that Evan Neal could go number one. Why that's significant next. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5, ESPN 92.5.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.